day before we have the wine reception at Centre, and then later on we'll also be going to the pub, but there'll be more details about that in a bit. So my name is Pedro, I'll be chairing, Juan couldn't make it, I will be taking his place, and we've got three presentations. The first one by Ricardo Antunes, who's a full professor of sociology of work at Unicamp, entitled The Precariat and the New Proletariat, Differences Between the Working Class of the North and the South, followed by Lorenzo Felton from the University of Warwick, and Kira Brenner, PhD candidate in international development here on SOAS. The paper is called Tunisia's Transition to Neoliberalism, a Class Composition Approach. And finally, Joe Buckley, also PhD candidate in international development here at SOAS, will be speaking on the political composition of strikes in Vietnam. We've all got 20 minutes, so I'll remind you when you've got 10, 5, and when it's time to wrap up. Without further ado, Ricardo, please. One last month. The session is being recorded. If anyone's got a qualm with that, let us know.
It's a pleasure to meet you, stay here in Historical Materialism Conference. Sorry, my English is not good enough. I will try to explain my text. During the debate, Professor Janaína will help me do the translation. My presentation is Precariat, New Proletariat, and Difference Between the North and the South Working Class. In the recent decades, the spread of information, technology, industrial automation, and other advances has inspired visions of a coming post-industrial society of services in which the proletariat would effectively disappear. The reality of the global labor class today, however, belies this myth. The great majority of the new jobs in the call center and telemarketing, hotels and cleaning companies to retail, fast food and care services, etc., are seasonal, part-time, temporary, informal, or freelance. Thank you. With little or no security or benefits. An emblematic example is the zero-hour contract in the United Kingdom and elsewhere. Once they receive this call, they are paid only for the time they actually work and not for the time spent waiting. Uber is another example. The company's drivers, who are treated as independent contractors, must provide their own cars and pay for all expenses, includes repairs, insurance, fuel, etc. The Uber app is, in fact, a global private enterprise that uses wage labor masked as independent work to appropriate a larger share of the surplus value. Still, another example of the precarious forms of labor exploitation can be found in Italy, where a novel form of occasional and intermittent work was introduced. Male and female were paid with vouchers, with value corresponded to the exact number of hours they worked. But this is not the only problem with this form of labor. The vouchers had to be paid at the legal minimum, but contractors also offered to pay overtime hours of a rate below the legal minimum. For this reason, Italy trade unions denounced the practice and the government was compelled to suspend it in the last years. The spread of these new forms of casual, part-time, temporary, independent, occasional, and intermittent work was giving rise to a new category of labor, the so-called precariat, a movement of self-identified members of the precariat is quite expanding in Europe, especially Italy, Spain, Portugal, elsewhere. Thus, the uberization, inverted commas, of labor is a ruthless modus operandi aimed at generating more profit and increasing the value of capital. It has expanded to a global scale. In addition, the fact that more and more work is done online has made it almost impossible to separate labor from leisure, and the employees are available for work at any and all time, with no pre-established working days, no clearly defined working space, no fixed wages, no fixed activities, no rates, no protection, and no representation by trade unions. The system of goals itself is flexible. Tomorrow's goals are always changing and must always be superior to those the previous day. The rise of this new labor regime, however, poses difficult questions. One, should workers in the service sectors be considered an emerging middle class? Two, or should be treated as a new class, the so-called precariat? Three, or should be considered part of a new proletariat of services? In the call centers, hotels, cleaning companies to retail, supermarkets, fast food, etc., have grown increasingly separated from the intellectual work, typical of the middle class, and are coming more and more to resemble what be called a new proletariat of services. In the top of the middle class, they are nearer to the owning classes, as with the middle and upper level managers, administrators, engineers, doctors, and lawyers. But others, particularly the poorer segments of the middle class, live and work in conditions quite similar to those of the working class. Salaried workers find themselves rapidly approaching to the condition of a new proletariat that is expanding globally. The new service proletariat workers longer hours with intensified rhythms, right turnover, and reduced wages in condition of growing insecurity, poor health, and minimal social protection. For this, today, the new proletariat are the protagonists of many social struggles and strikes around the world. An emblematic case can be found in Portugal, where occurred the discontent of the Geração Arrasca, struggling generation. In Spain, with the movement of indignados protesting against right levels for unemployment and the complete lack of life prospects. But pioneering example can be found in Italy, the May Day outbreak in Milan, when gave birth to the San Precario, a movement that represents the heterogeneous mass of works, youths, immigrants, etc. Another Italy movement of precarious workers include the Clash City Workers, group with a presence in Naples, and in their words, this the auto-defining. Our name means fighting workers of the metropolis. Our movement was founded in middle 29. We are particularly active in Naples, Florence, Milan, and Bergamo. Apart from this, the new trade unions organizations have been founded to represent the more precarious segment of the proletariat, include the Confederazione Unitaria di Base, and more recently the NIDIL, Nova Identidade Lavoro, an acronym for New Working Identity, which is part of the Confederazione Generale Italiana di Lavoro, Italian Confederation of Labor, one of the country's main traditional trade unions organizations. Contrarily to the new middle class and the new class, I believe that the new morphology of the class that lives on its labor should include distinct segments, according to my book, The Meaning of Work, that was published by High Market, right? The idea of the class that lives on its labor. In fact, the working class has always been divided by internal differentiation of gender, generation, ethnicity, nationality, migration, skills, etc. The precariat for us, thus, is a distinct segment of the working class. In all its heterogeneity, differentiation, and fragmentation. In the North countries, the more precarious members of labor, including youths, immigrants, people of color, and others, is part of the proletariat or the working class. In the contemporary age, the relative surplus population, which Marx in Capital designates as floating, latent, or stagnant, get new dimension. This occurs, for example, through the enormous expansion of immigrant labors on a global scale, multiplying the mechanism of exploitation of the surplus value. Given the international division, given the international division of labor and the disequal and combined condition, it is necessary to conclude by noting some mediations. One important point concerned to the cleavage between the global north and the south. In the peripheries, the proletariat has been burdened with precariousness from the beginning. In the colonial past in Brazil and other countries of America Latina, and I think we can think about Africa condition, maybe Asia too, but I am talking about Brazil and some countries of America Latina, the proletariat emerged directly after the abolition of slavery. Consequently, precarious for the Latin American working class has always been the role, not the exception. The countries of the South, the peripheries, never developed an aristocracy of labor, a segment skilled and rightly paid. In the South, the proletariat has always been associated with the condition of precariousness. The recent development of a precariat has generated a differentiation in the proletariat of the North, but that has no parallel or no similar condition with the South working class. Here in the South, the condition of the so-called precariat is more the role and less the exception. The intensification of labor, the erosion of rights, the super-exploitation, I don't know if it's super-exploitation or over-exploitation, the expansion of informal, the super exploitation of labor with the differential rate of exploitation, the expansion of informal employment, the degraded salaries, the enormous working hours, the prevalence of the harassment, illness, and death, all these are the normal and not the exception in the history of the working class in periphery or in the South. For this reason, the debate about the precariat as a new class has caused some confusion, not only in the North, but especially when applied to the global South. This is my principal idea. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ricardo.
Tunisia's transition to neoliberalism, which started officially in 1986 and continues, the neoliberalization process continues through today. The main idea of our paper is that the Tunisian transition to neoliberalism was shaped by the cycle of struggles conducted by the working class during the infitah, or opening period, and that would be the social and economic period right before the neoliberal period, which again started in 1986. So just to kind of put this into a more scholarly background, most of the scholarship on the Tunisian Revolution in 2012 focuses on the UGTT, the Union Générale Tunisienne du Travail, the Tunisian General Trade Union Federation, which until 2011 was the only legal trade union federation in Tunisia, and within that, formal sector workers. There are some other streams of scholarship that are looking at economic policies that inspired the revolution. We're kind of trying to synthesize these two understandings by looking at how social and economic policies created the composition of the working class that conducted the cycle of struggles leading to the neoliberalization of Tunisia, and how that can be a framework for understanding the Tunisian revolution. So we use a class composition framework. I'm just going to quote Churchetto, 2007. The bond between the objective technical characteristics evinced by labor power at a given historical moment as a result of its position within the capitalist organization of the production process and its subjective political characteristics. So to break that down a little bit, technical composition is more about how workers are directly incorporated into capitalist production. So who makes up the labor force, where they work, the type of work that they engage in, etc. And the political composition is about how workers have unified to combat capital. And just a quick note on class, because we're at historical materialism, it's important to note that our understanding of class is a bit more heterodox than the orthodox Marxist understanding of class. This is very important in the Tunisian context, that we include people who are unemployed, underemployed, precariously employed, or employed within the informal sector. The best data that I could find on the number of people employed in the Tunisian informal sector is about 35%. Likewise, the unemployment rate is officially at 18%, but Tunisia provides no social welfare for people who are unemployed, so almost everyone who is technically unemployed has some type of casual employment. Those numbers are higher for people with university degrees. So a man with a university education is about has a 20% unemployment rate, women have about a 30% unemployment rate, and those numbers are all known to be deflated.
All right.
That's interesting. So anyway, we're moving now into the empirical part of the presentation. So what we're gonna do is more of a historical paper showing how class struggle and the construction of the balance of class power shaped the experience of Tunisian neoliberalism. And that's, I guess, our polemical target are institutionalist approaches, which we spend the morning traveling, which are dominant in the study of, for example, labor-state relations in North Africa. And normally, the trade unions in institutionalist approaches tend to be seen as proxies for the working class. So, you know, you can have people say, does labor support democracy or not? And they go like, look, the trade union didn't support democracy, so workers are against democracy. While we advocate, and well, I guess, you know, since we are in liberalism, this point would probably be less controversial than in a Middle Eastern studies conference, that it is necessary to disaggregate between different sections of the working class and the trade unions as mediating instances of part of the systems of labor institutions of a given country. And our basic understanding is that it is self-activity of the workers that can push trade union leaderships to take one direction rather than another. And so this is the basic assumption behind our interpretation of the empirical evidence. So just to give some context, we are periodizing post-independence Tunisian development with a populist phase from the early 60s until the 70s, when there was a beginning of a transition. So in the populist phase, have a populist regime which is based on state bureaucracy and the bourgeoisie in the making that were sort of leaders of the nationalist independence movement in an alliance with the organized working class, namely the UCTT, that also had a very important role in the cycle of struggle for national liberation, and that gave the organized working class a very important political place in the post-independence regime. And so those class factions that were excluded from the regime were, on one hand, the Beylikal elite, which means the monarchical, so to speak, although that's an imprecise word, elite that was there before independence and before colonization and that has struck an alliance with the French colonizers, and the countryside. So peasants were being dispossessed by colonization first and then state takeover of the lands of the colons, so they were being proletarianized, but they were not organized in the UGTT, so they were sort of outside of the populist class compromise. Economic policy at the time was your case of import substitution industrialization, so you had protective tariffs, so that the state could create enterprises in heavy industry owned by the state, and it was a land reform which was limited to the land that used to be owned by the colons, and they were turning to agricultural enterprises directed by the state. And in terms of the labor institutions, you had an instance of authoritarian corporatism, so a triangular state party union architecture in which leadership in the trade union led to leadership in the single party, and the trade union was a single trade union. And positions in the administration of the state. So this was a whole set of inducements to the trade unionists, but also real concessions to the workers in terms of expansion of the public sector, rising wages after 66. Then you also had repression of dissent. So there was, during this phase of development, a very important change in the technical composition of the class. Just to be quick, very impressive increase in the level of education and decline of the agriculture employment and increase in industrial employment and service employment. So it was the very class composition that was brought about by import substitution industrialization, which was in turn, you know, a result of the previous cycle of struggles for national liberation. So it's that very class composition that put the system in crisis through a cycle of struggle in the 70s and the 80s that were part of a more global cycle of struggle. So it was led by industrial service workers and intellectual workers in the public administration organizing the UGTT. But the UGTT was a cooperative, nationalist, interclassist trade unions in its ideology and early policies. And it was a strike wave that began in the early 70s and culminated in terms of statistical number of strikes and days lost in 77 and 81. That pushed the trade union leadership to declare national general strike on 26 January 1978. It's very interesting to note that right until January 78, Habib Ashour, the Secretary General of the trade union, was also a member of the executive committee of the single party. So the union was allied to the regime, and yet they declared a national general strike, was repressed through the army, the whole trade union leadership was imprisoned. This cycle of struggle has spelled the impossibility of the continuation of capitalist accumulation within populism and import substitution industrialization. And so it coincided with this period of transition that with the overall defeat of the cycle of struggle would result in a neoliberal structural adjustment.
So one of the ways that the crisis was dealt with was by the implementation of a structural adjustment program starting in 1986 that was formalized in the 1987 to 1992 Seventh Development Plan. So this plan was kind of the beginning of neoliberalism in Tunisia. Neoliberalism obviously takes a lot of forms, touches many, many broad sectors of both social and economic life. We're pretty much just talking about things that directly touch the working class and create a new disciplinary regime here. And then Lorenzo's going to talk about changes to labor institutions that also help to discipline the working class and deal with the crisis. But so in the development plan, a couple of things that directly targeted the UGTT were the proposed change to having the UGTT had traditionally negotiated national sectoral contracts for all of its members. The development plan insisted on a firm-based collective bargaining, which would have meant that the UGTT needed to strongly organize in every single firm across Tunisia, which was particularly difficult, particularly in the interior regions that are traditionally underdeveloped as opposed to the coast. Likewise, they wanted a pay scale that was based on experience and productivity rather than longevity at the firm. Again, this is a direct attack on the UGTT's negotiated contracts. The state also paid a lot of attention to the very high unemployment rate in these development plans. Tunisia, at the time of this first development plan, had an unemployment rate of about 18%. And so the development plan was meant to deal with that. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. They also implemented a wage policy that held wages below inflation for the first time pretty much ever in the history of Tunisia. The state also retreated from its role in social reproduction, which had previously been quite strong, as evidenced by the incredible achievements in education. This was done particularly in the area of healthcare provision and in basic needs through things like food subsidies. Also, labor law was amended to allow short-term and part-time contracts, something the UGTT had been very against previously. However, that didn't all happen. So the proposed changes to the collective bargaining structure never actually happened. It's codified into law, but they still maintain a national sectoral collective bargaining structure. The policies around unemployment didn't help the unemployment problem, as they were particularly focused on population growth reduction. Tunisia had an increase in population primarily because people were living past 50, not because of an increased birth rate. Likewise, they focused on creating jobs in the textile and leather sector by encouraging FDI specifically to this sector. However, that sector was traditionally feminized and remains highly feminized today. So it didn't actually deal with the unemployment problem, it just broadened labor force participation by incorporating more women into the labor force. So the unemployment rate at the end of the five-year development plan was actually 19%, which was higher than 18% at the beginning of it. As I mentioned earlier, wage growth was held below inflation, so there was a decrease in real wages, but only from 1987 till 1990, which was not the goal of the wage plan, the wage policy. The state also heightened eligibility for free health services, implementing a means-based test for that, and also a fee-for-services approach for people who fell outside of the means test area. The state also reduced subsidies on basic goods, such as bread and cooking oil, but maintained them for other things, particularly fertilizer for agribusiness and industrial farms. And the changes to the labor law weren't actually implemented until 1994 and 1996, when they were demanded basically by the European Union. So as you can see from this structure, the way that neoliberalism was implemented, at least beginning in Tunisia, doesn't really touch on the strongholds of the organized working class. The collective bargaining structure wasn't changed, and basically the neoliberal attacks on the working class fall primarily towards people who aren't organized into the UGTT, fall outside of the formal sector, and state employment. And so you see this kind of attack on the poorest populations, people who are in informal work, precarious work, or unemployed. And now Lorenzo's going to talk about labor institutions.
So I broke down labor institutions in three dimensions: concessions to the workers, inducements for the trade union as an organization, and constraints, i.e. repression. So what is interesting to see is that there was a neoliberal retrenchment of concessions that affecting one way or another the working class as a whole. So you had the flexibilization of the formal labor market with the labor cut reform of 94 and the other one in 96. public sector was downsized, privatizations, or in those industries, they remained publicly owned. Sometimes the labor force was downsized through restructuring. But this happened to a lesser extent than what was demanded by the international financial institutions. So you still have relatively large industrial public sector in Tunisia up to today. And in terms of real wages and welfare, there was a retrenchment in the sense that the average increase in yearly spending on welfare and real wages increased at a much lower rate than what it used to be in the populist phase. So in the populist phase as a whole, there was a real wage increase of 6% per year, while in the neoliberal phase, which is just 1.3%, so it's significantly lower according to the databases that are available. But they still increased, right? There wasn't an absolute loss, as sometimes it is assumed. In terms of labor institutions, after the struggles of the 70s and 80s, a formal intersection between the trade union and the state party was no longer viable, because one of the main demands of the 70s was the independence of the trade union from the single party. Therefore, some formal inducements were maintained. For example, the UGTT was still the single trade union. It was a check-off system in the public sector, funding from the Social Security Fund, secondments mostly paid by the state. But the formal intersection between the trade union and the party were downscaled, and this was imposed through a Congress of the UGTT in 1981. And they were compensated with your typical neoliberal patron-client relations between a section of the trade union leadership and the state. And so the UGTT was reincorporated in a post-populist cooperative system that was looser compared to the one that was there before. And national sectoral collective bargaining, as Kira said, was maintained, and it was influenced by the state for its own political priorities. But still, the system of collective bargaining most advanced in the region. What really persisted was repression. So civil and political rights under Bernardi was still very much limited. Anti-union illegal behavior was widespread in the private sector, Also, unlike many other countries of region, the trade union managed to establish a solid presence in a fraction of the private sector that was necessary for it to have legitimacy to negotiate the national sectorial contracts. And internal democracy initiative was controlled by the state, but it had to tolerate dissent from all of those political groups and rank and file that had built up during the struggle of the 70s and the 80s and that survived to some extent. Just to jump to the conclusions, our interpretation of Tunisia's transition to neoliberalism is sort of an alternative to top-down approaches that can be institutionalist approaches, but also economic structural approaches, either from the liberal side. So it's just that state-owned firms didn't happen to be competitive, and they had necessarily by economic laws to be reformed, focusing on the laws of capital accumulation through the wrong logic, because there is a strong point to be made that those struggles, as part of a global cycle of struggle, shaped the way neoliberalism was applied to Tunisia in a different way from other countries in the world. And arguably, other accounts of labor-state relations in Tunisia overestimated the extent to which labor had been co-opted and had become part of the regime and was not able to constitute a force of opposition anymore, while the 2011 Tunisian uprising or revolution, call it as you will, tended to prove the opposite. So that falls outside of the scope of the paper, but obviously where questions on more recent years are also welcome, and thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Perfect timekeeping again. Right, hello everybody. Okay, so let's talk about strikes in Vietnam. Right, so as Pedro said, I'm PhD in international development here at SOAS. So, political composition of strikes in Vietnam. Well, firstly, a bit of background and context. So, Vietnam, nominally communist state, led by the Vietnamese Communist Party, transitioned to a market economy in the 1980s after an economic crisis in the late 70s following the end of the Second Indochina War. Throughout the 90s and the 2000s, rapid capitalist growth, growth success story, reduction in poverty, blah, blah, blah. Export-oriented production was essential for this. The first major export industry was garments, and now it's also electronics, still the two biggest. Lots of rural to urban migration behind this industrialization and growth. Lots of women, majority of line workers in big factories now are women, 70%-ish in industrial production. Supervisors and team leaders are disproportionately men in relation to the amount of male line workers. So many of these industrial workers are young, leave the industry exhausted by the mid to late 30s because they can't cope with the effort it takes to be an industrial worker, and return to home villages in rural areas. Formal work. Vietnamese government and the ILO are very keen on talking about how formal work in Vietnam is expanding and the formal economy is expanding and all this. Well, by that they mean more people getting jobs in formally registered firms. So from that perspective, it's correct, but within that formal economy, work is becoming much more precarious. So people pay minimum wages. Minimum wage legislation was an outcome of previous struggle in the mid-2000s, which aren't enough to live on, and then a flexible piece rate top of wage on top of that. Employers cheat with contracts, keeping people on successions of short-term contracts. Automation threatens jobs, and foreign companies sometimes flee the country with loads of unpaid wages and social insurance contributions with impunity. So, one party, Socialist Republic, led by the Vietnamese Communist Party. There's no freedom of association in Vietnam. You have one state-led state-led union federation, the Vietnam General Confederation of Labour, the VGCL. So, when people are talking about the danger of taking union membership and behaviour as a proxy for the working class, it's very easy to not do that in the Vietnamese case. The right to strike does exist. It was legalised in 1994. Since then, there have been hundreds of strikes every year, but not one strike has ever been legal, because to undertake a legal strike requires jumping through ridiculous bureaucratic mechanisms, including that the strike led by the VGCL, which they don't do. So all strikes are technically wildcat strikes. Most strikes largely in foreign invested factories producing for export, although not exclusively. There's some in state-owned factories, some in domestic private factories, but there's very, very few strikes in industries other than industrial production. I can think of one, which was for a ride-hailing app earlier this year. So discussions of freedom of association are live debates now in Vietnam at the government level, but sensitive. So kick-started by negotiations over the TPP, but these have continued after the TPP failed with the CPTPP, and there's still a serious consideration about freedom of association in Vietnam, although Vietnam hasn't ratified ILO Conventions 87 and 98 relating to FOA, collective bargaining, and the right to organise. So the existing literature on why workers strike, there's bits on why strikes are always wildcat, gains achieved, etc., etc., but I wanted to know, given this discussion at the kind of government level, Ministry of Labour level, VGCL level, on freedom of association, how are strikes actually organised when they happen? How are wildcat strikes actually organised? So my research is based on 86 semi-scripted interviews, mainly with workers, also some capitalists and some other people, labour activists, government officials, union bureaucrats, etc., etc. So from that, the general features of wildcat strikes in Vietnam. So they often last at least a day. Now, recording of wildcat strikes is a total mess. But in 2015, there were 316 recorded strikes, 286 in 2016, 314 in 2017. I also suspect that there's hundreds of much smaller work stoppages that go on inside factory walls that escape statistics as well. But these wildcat strikes, recorded strikes, usually last at least a day, and then can range from one day to weeks. Demands, vast majority of the time, are bread and butter demands, wage demands, demands over working conditions, social insurance payments, that sort of stuff. There are a few exceptions. So 2005 to 2006 had a massive strike wave over minimum wage legislation, which got a minimum wage legislation actually introduced when it didn't exist before. In 2015, there was a big strike over a proposed change to social insurance contributions, which won as well. And there's also some political ones, strikes about China. So there were riots in 2014 over, supposedly over China's behaviour in the South China Sea, although it's a real mess. It looks like it was a lot more complicated than that. And in June this year, June 2018, lots of strikes over a proposed law on special economic zones, because people argued that that would lead to China taking over the country. But apart from that, Hector's writing a dissertation on this, so you can ask him about that later. But mainly bread and butter demands. So who strikes? Well, it's primarily line workers, and this excludes other parts of the working class. So security guards, cleaners, catering staff, mechanics in these factories are often not part of the strikes. These workers are usually outsourced workers working for, well, employed technically by different companies. Security guards and cleaners especially are often older workers. And security guards, mechanics are often men, cleaners often women, catering staff can be either. And one mechanic I spoke to actually kind of phrase his position in opposition to the line workers, because he said, well, I only start working when they stop working, when they sabotage a machine or whatever, then I've got to go and fix it. The line leaders, the team leaders, the supervisors in factories are caught in between capital and labour. This is a very nice phrase that one of my worker friends came up with. So these people often used to be line workers, then got promoted, and they have a very kind of complex relation to strikes in general. Some give tacit support, some give open support. Some oppose the strikes because kind of their wages are reliant on how much is produced, etc. And that opposition can be tacit opposition, I wish they weren't doing this, and can be open opposition to trying to lock workers inside factories to stop them going on strike. So, I think strikes are decentralised with no sustained worker leaders. Now, this is different to lots of scholarship, which often talks about informal leaders in Vietnam. But I haven't found that. I've rarely found any cases of sustained leaders. When I have, those people have usually been vilified or given the sack by employers. What does happen is temporary representatives who rotate during a strike, you know, oh, today I'll go and speak to the employer and tomorrow someone else can. This serves two purposes. Firstly, it stops management from targeting specific people. And secondly, it stops management from buying off those representatives, which is a concern of workers that they'll be kept in the pocket of management and sell out the strike. Social media is a very important avenue for discussion, and it was interesting what Achille was saying this morning about the Uber Eats strike organised through a WhatsApp group. Well, Facebook here is very, very important during strikes. And again, as Achille was saying, when it's not a strike time, these groups are usually just like people joking, sending memes around. Well, it's the same in Vietnam. Facebook groups of workers at factories are often joking. This is what Campbell would call everyday class recomposition. But then they become a major forum for talking about strike demands and how strikes are progressing when a strike's going on. Now, the union... Most workers are neither against it nor for it. They see it as basically irrelevant to their lives. And there's kind of a fair bit of scholarship talking about, can a state or union represent workers? Yes or no, this and that. And then some people say, no, workers are against the union. Some people say workers trust the union. Thank you. I found often they're not against the union. They trust it not to be against them actively, but it means kind of nothing to them. The exception to this are some of the more militant workers who are anti-union. And, crucially, there are no demands for independent worker organisations as part of strikes. I know of one exception to this, which we might deal with during the Q&A. So, a case study. Right. Please don't take pictures of this slide. These are from friends who were involved in the strike, and when they found out I was going to speak about it, they said, oh, you've got to send our pictures up, show them. So, this is a factory which has over 10,000 workers. It's a Taiwanese-owned factory, produces shoes, primarily for a major international brand. Workers work on a rotation of 3 shifts per day, so the factory goes on 24 hours. The exception to this is on Sunday, where every worker has a day off. So it's a massive compound. If you look along here, this is all the factory compound. And inside that, there's a smaller kind of workshops in which workers work. Production targets increased each year, unhygienic practices, verbal abuse, workers often threatened with the sack and told they can easily be replaced by robots. Factory managers also threaten to just flee the country without paying workers if they don't work harder. Currently, attempts to replace long-serving workers at this factory with workers on one-year contracts that are not then renewed. So what started this strike was a proposed change in the factory's salary policy, where previously there were 24 salary levels for workers and you'd raise one each year. The company proposed cutting this to just 8 salary levels. So most people working on salary of 9 to 24 would take a pay cut, and everyone else would max out at 8. So workers were on Facebook talking about what does this policy mean, what are the implications of it, trying to work it out. So first they wanted to understand what it meant. Then, when they did understand what it meant, they talked about going on strike. Now, I was sat in Saigon, this is a satellite city of Saigon, and got a WhatsApp message from one of my friends who's a worker at this factory saying, oh, it's all kicking off at the factory. We might be going on strike. And I said, oh, when are you going on strike? She said, I don't know. How can I know? Because it's decentralised. So she didn't know exactly when the strike would break out, but the feeling was obvious that there would be a strike. So it broke out on a Friday morning, and in one workshop, and then workers were coming down, walking around the compound, shouting for other workers to come out and join the strike, putting on Facebook, oh, workshop F14, where are you? Come on down. One supervisor tried to lock some workers in their workshop. So workers inside there posted on Facebook saying we're being locked in, and then all the workers outside went and surrounded that workshop, so they had to be let out to join the strike. And that was on a Friday morning. Then the afternoon workers came along, joined in as well. So within this strike, there were lots of small groups of workers taking autonomous actions. So one guy used some very pungent shrimp paste to stop scab labour, which is a standard way to stop scab labour in Vietnam. And in that spirit, I've been to Chinatown. Now, he wanted me to stress that this isn't as smelly as the one he uses. If you open that and have a sniff, pass one that way, one that way. So if this stinks, and also it gets on your clothes, doesn't wash out for days. But again, this was an autonomous action undertaken by small groups of workers.
Yes, you
It's enough because the smell is coming.
It's a multi-sensory presentation. Actually.
How did you dispense that?
He threw it. They offered to ship some over for the UCU strike. So if there's any striking workers here who want to use that to stop scouts, feel free. 5 minutes, shit.
Cadê o papel?
Oh,
yeah.
I'm distracted at the
presentation. His entire presentation was just excuse me.
Now we can leave the room.
Yeah.
I see your point.
So blocking the road as well, this was another autonomous action. So workers naturally spilled out onto the road because you can't all fit on that grassy verge, and then some workers took it upon themselves to stop traffic. And this was an effort to try and force state agencies to talk to the factory owners to sort the strike. Don't give it back. So negotiations during this strike. No one from the company management ever came down to talk to the workers. They distributed announcements, flyering announcements out, and the first one just said, oh, we're still considering this policy, please go back to work, and they didn't, obviously. And then with the various announcements, workers were discussing on Facebook, what, do we want to accept this? Do we not want to accept this? So in the end, at the end of Saturday, the second day of the strike, the workers had a day off, and they were discussing all day on Facebook, should we accept this this offer from the management to withdraw this policy and various other things. And in the end they did, went back to work on the Monday. I can go into more detail in the Q&A if you want. But, so in conclusion then, these strikes are leaderless, not rudderless. It does not require a union-led strike because there's no sustained worker representatives and there's no kind of centralised way of making decisions. Workers are not demanding independent unions, except in one case. And this form of resistance seems to be successful at achieving immediate demands in an epoch of flexible neoliberal production, even though it's not speaking to challenging broader structures of accumulation. So I think that raises important questions of what relevance do debates about freedom of association in Vietnam currently going on at high levels have to the actual experience of workers on the ground? They seem quite far removed. Okay, the end. Thank you.